from the Mount Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The Super Tuesday voting is done, which means the counting has begun. We'll take a peek at who's feeling good today and who has some catching up to do. Plus, the perception of Hollywood is that it leans liberal, but even among those there that do, political battle lines have been drawn between Biden and Sanders. Hear who stands by each presidential candidate. That and more coming up on Take Two, so stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. We're going to just jump right in. We'll have an update on the quest by the Orange County School for the Arts to renew its charter, but the rest of today is really all about the primary. Of course, what else? I mean, Super Tuesday culminated in a riveting evening with both Democratic hopefuls claiming victory.
But tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination. And we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of this country.
And we're told, well, when he got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy. Yeah. Tell that to the folks in Virginia, yeah. North Carolina, yeah. Alabama, yeah. Tennessee, yeah. Oklahoma, yeah. Arkansas, yeah. Minnesota.
Meanwhile, in Southern California, voters turned out big with many braving long lines to cast their ballots. Now, for a look at where things stand as of this afternoon, let's talk to KPCC politics reporter Libby Denkman. Hello, Libby.
Hi, A.
All right, I want to start with some late breaking news on the elections. This is in regards to LA County's new touchscreen voting machines. The county shelled out $300 million to roll them out this election. What is the latest?
Well, things didn't go as smoothly as I think the county would have liked. Of course, we saw long lines yesterday at many polling places. The Registrar of Voters, Dean Logan, said last night that the actual voting machines, the ballot marking devices, once you got inside the vote centers, performed fine. But there was a big problem with the check-in process as people were arriving to vote. The iPad tablets that were used to process voter information and to call up their ballots for printing, that was a real cause for choke points at many vote centers. We saw lines of 2.5-3 hours at USC, at Cal State University, Northridge, all kinds of places. There's no doubt that there were also a lot of the ballot marking machines themselves that had been taken out of service for various reasons, paper jams. There were oftentimes employees didn't know how to reboot the machine or turn them on in the first place. The registrar's office had estimated earlier in the day that some machines, it could be up to 20% that were out of service. That could have been, of course, a number of problems that need to be investigated. And Supervisor Janice Hahn called today. She filed a motion to ask for that investigation. The registrar himself said yesterday that there would need to be a forensic analysis of what went on.
Oh, wow. But,
you know, there's other issues, too, not just technical. The registrar said that it was really difficult to predict, because of this new vote center model, exactly where the most people would be turning out. The college campuses, like I mentioned, down. Town yeah. spots were especially hard hit and did not have enough capacity. There was poll worker training issues. There was issues with the awareness of the early voting period that people could have taken advantage of, say like the Monday before Super Tuesday. But it's hard to change people's habits, eh?
Yeah.
And, you know, the expectation, too, is that a lot of people held on to their ballots to see what would have happened in South Carolina. And it's a good thing they did, since the field did change so much. So still don't know exactly what happened, but there is that push from the county now to look into what caused these severe delays.
Yeah, the county's trying something new, so I was willing to give them a pass on a lot as I was getting to my first vote center choice. The line was really long, so I figured I'll go to choice number two, Libby. I went to choice number two, and the line was super short, so I thought, okay, awesome.
Great.
That's where I'm going, right? That short line took an hour and a half, so I think that was the frustrating part for me, was that that line was too short to last 90 minutes.
How long was the first line, I wonder, if you saw it and you said no thanks, and then the second one was 90 minutes?
Wrapped around the library in Burbank,
around
the corner.
Gosh.
So that's why I thought, okay, I'll just find somewhere else. But that was the frustrating part. And then when I got to the front, just one desk processing people. Four desks set up, one desk processing
people.
So
it was at your vote center also a check-in problem,
yeah.
It looked like.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you like the machines once you actually used them?
That was awesome. That was like really fast. I got in and out of there in like a few minutes. minutes.
Yep. So again, that's what Dean Logan blamed first and foremost was that machine to check in. It's not clear whether or not it was a syncing issue with the state voter database or if it was an actual problem with the tablets themselves or the software on there. So again, still need to investigate that.
Now, even though LA did roll out the new vote system model, they did not switch all voters to mail-in ballots. Other counties in California have. But maybe it was good that they didn't, Libby, because several presidential candidates dropped out before Super Tuesday. 360,000 votes were cast here for candidates who dropped. Have you heard frustration over this from people?
Of course we have. I mean, we were talking last week about folks who wanted to change their votes. Was that just Monday, that we were talking? Honestly, the time has just, it's been hard to keep track lately. But people were upset. Say they cast an early vote by mail ballot for Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar, and they thought, I feel like I'm throwing my vote away and I would like to change it. That is not possible. You can't change a vote once you've cast it. But certainly Super Tuesday was so consequential. California voters had those vote by mail ballots for a full month, and many folks did decide to cast it early and see where the chips may fall.
I can't give a pass to people on that one. Look, you voted. That's it. You voted. That's politics. You take a chance.
But they thought they had full information and they didn't. I don't know. I'm just trying to be a devil's advocate here.
You're trying to be nice. That's your problem, maybe.
Oh, is that what it is?
that's absolutely it.
Human kindness.
All right, let's look at District 25. That's Northern LA County. That's Katie Hill's seat before she resigned. She beat out Republican Steve Knight in 2018. He decided to try again this year. Where do things stand in District 25? As of this afternoon,
it's a really interesting race that's shaped up there. Mike Garcia, the former Navy fighter pilot who's an executive at Raytheon, who ran just a long shot campaign that started last spring before Katie Hill, the former congresswoman there in the North LA County District and Eastern Ventura County District, before she stepped down. Mike Garcia was running and running a grassroots campaign, chugging along up there, getting his name out there. And then all of a sudden, everything opened up when Katie Hill announced she would be leaving the entire district. It flooded with opponents. Some people didn't even live in the district. George Papadopoulos, the guy who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI involved in the Mueller investigation, ended up declaring for a candidacy there. But right now, it looks as though Mike Garcia will beat out Steve Knight, the former congressman who lost to Katie Hill in 2018. And his opponent will be the Assemblywoman Christy Smith, who overlaps much of that district in her Assembly district. And so Christy was sort of the Democratic consensus that everybody got behind, all the electeds got behind right away when Katie Hill got out. She's had a really strong volunteer base, folks door knocking and getting the word out for her. But there's a really a lot of energy up there in the 25th district from Republicans who say, Steve Knight couldn't beat Katie Hill last time around, but we're not going to let that happen this time. However, got to say, the demographics are moving against Republicans in the 25th. It's getting younger. It's getting more diverse. So, most watchers still say it has a lean Democratic tilt to it.
All right, let's go to to Orange County. Freshman Democrats who rode that blue wave to victory in 2018 faced some runoffs against some well-funded opponents. How do things shake out there so far?
Sure. Let's start at the coast. Harley Ruda's district, the Democrat who beat Dana Rohrabacher in 2018. That's the 48th district, includes Huntington Beach, Seal Beach, Costa Mesa. Republican Orange County Supervisor Michelle Steele, who was the odds-on favorite, very well-funded, well-known in that area, is going to be his opponent. And she performed extremely well in that primary. Then we move over to the 39th district, the Gil Cisneros district. He won against a really hard-fought race, in a hard-fought race against Young Kim, the former staffer for Ed Royce, who was the incumbent there. Now, Young Kim is back, and Young Kim will be in the runoff in November. She outperformed Cisneros in the return so far, but of course, primaries are usually a really strong performance for Republicans there. But it will be a really interesting race to watch in the 39th district. And then we move over to Irvine in the 45th with Katie Porter, really big star already in the Democratic Party, huge fundraising numbers. She is now going to be facing the mayor of Mission Viejo, Greg Raths, who emerged from a really crowded field of Republicans. A lot of people jumped in, at least five opponents, to try to get that Republican, the second spot in the top two. Greg Raths looks like he's going to take it, and Katie Porter and Greg Raths will be facing each other in November. But again, she's very formidable there in being an Elizabeth Warren protege and well-known nationally.
One more thing. Tale of two candidates. Maybe it's Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden. They both have had really big nights. What do we see from California voters on Sanders and Biden?
You know, late breaking voters, folks who held onto their ballots or waited till day of, did break for Biden. Sanders appears to have handily won the state as well as most congressional districts, except for the most conservative. But Latinos buoyed Sanders to victory in California. They did not get him across the finish line in Texas, which is a really interesting comparison case to populations with a large Latino community. So we are going to be watching going forward, you know, what it means in these other states, Michigan coming up, you know, Big Tuesday. We have Super Tuesday is done and Big Tuesday is next. So, you know, certainly the consolidation by the moderates behind Biden completely changed the trajectory of this race. And it has just become a classic, one for the ages.
Like it or not, there is intrigue, right?
It really is. Yeah.
Libby Denkman is KPCC's politics reporter. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
And coming up later in the show, we're going to check in on some down ballot races and what happened in Orange County. So stick around for that. All right, now to the other major headline of today. Six new cases of corona infection have been identified in Los Angeles County, prompting county leaders to declare a local public health emergency this morning. Pasadena and Long Beach, both of which have their own health departments, have also declared local emergencies. And Placer County near Sacramento announced today the first California death from COVID-19. KPCC's Robert Garova has been following all of this. Robert, welcome back.
Hi.
All right. So what do we know about the new cases in LA County?
So those six new cases were confirmed within the last 48 hours or so. One person is hospitalized. The other five are isolated at home and are being closely monitored by LA Public Health. Three of those new cases, they had traveled together in northern Italy. And we know that's one of the countries that's been hit pretty hard by coronavirus. The good news, though, is that public health officials say even with these new cases, LA County still doesn't have any known cases of community transmission. That's when somebody gets the disease and they don't know where it came from, essentially. So health officials also say that the vast majority of people they've tested in LA didn't have the virus, and they've tested more than two dozen people, they say. Officials say we should be preparing for more cases to be confirmed in LA.
What do we know about California's first death from the disease? That's in Placer County.
So Placer County says the person was elderly with underlying health conditions. They also say the person had recently traveled. In this case, it was a Princess cruise last month from San Francisco to Mexico. They're largely echoing what we're seeing with deaths in Washington State and elsewhere. At a press conference announcing LA County's local health emergency this morning, this is what Public Health Director Dr. Barbara Ferrer had to say.
So we're doing a lot of work with our homeless services providers, and we're doing a lot of work with those people who care for the elderly. Not because we know for certain that it will show up in those populations, but more because we know if it does show up, those people are at higher risk for more severe illness.
All right, Robert. So LA County declares that local health emergency. What does that mean exactly?
So one big thing is that proclaiming a local emergency makes it easier to access state and federal relief funds if it comes to that. It also makes it easier, makes it clearer, what the rights are of officials who might need to enact social distancing measures. That could mean canceling large events or asking people who are infected to isolate themselves at home. We've seen several counties in California do this already. It's a push towards, hey, let's get prepared. Definitely not, as officials have said over and over, should it be a cause for panic. The cities of L.A., Pasadena, and Long Beach also announced local emergencies, like I think you said up at the top.
Yeah. Tell us more about these social distancing measures.
Here's how Ferrer explained it.
Use verbal salutations in place of handshakes and hugs. Don't share utensils, cups, and linens, and whenever possible, try to keep 6 feet between you and other people that you don't know at large events.
She also said public health is in talks with large venues in LA about the possibility of needing to cancel big events. That could mean soccer, NBA, or college basketball games played with no fans.
Major League Baseball season about to start. Yeah.
We saw Italy announce similar measures today. Not in LA yet, though. Ferrer said we're not at that point yet. She also said we should be prepared with a supply of essentials at home, no different than we should already have for earthquakes, fires, other natural disasters. And then, there's the fact that parents need to plan ahead for what could mean, we could see their kids' schools shutting down for the time being. Other than that, we're hearing the same message, which I know we've talked about over and over again. Wash your hands as much as possible. Stay home if you're sick.
All right, that's KPCC's Robert Gorova giving us the latest on coronavirus. Robert, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, more Take 2 coming up in 60 seconds. Don't go anywhere. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, down ballot, several other important races are headed to runoffs this November, just like the powerful L.A. City Council. Now, one of the most heated, Council District 4, including Hollywood, Mid-City, Koreatown, Los Feliz, and Silver Lake, is currently represented by David Rue. But the incumbent encountered a tough race and will likely go up against challenger Nithya Raman in the fall. And then in South L.A., the competition for Council District 10 is also very close. Departing L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas hopes to capture that city council seat, and he's up against Grace Yu, who's gunning for this position a second time. Here to break down these two races and what voters in these neighborhoods were looking for, we have John Regardi, who covers local politics for Los Angeles Magazine. John, welcome back.
Thank you, A.
All right, so first off, how close is the race for District 4 right now at the moment?
As of this moment, the latest details I heard, David Rue, the incumbent, had 46.75% of the vote, so he is short of the 50% that he needs to win outright. Now, Nithya Raman has performed very well. She's within 8%. It's about 38.3%. There was another candidate, Sarah Kate Levy, who had a little bit under 15%. So unless things change and David Rue gets over that 50%, it's going to be essentially, Groundhog Day of politics, but, with 8 more months of campaigning.
Heading into this, John, did it surprise you that an incumbent candidate like him didn't just get the outright win?
I was very surprised because not only do incumbent city council members almost never lose, they almost are never even pushed into runoffs. There's only been one, incumbent within the past 20 years who didn't win. Not only that, David Rue had so much going for him. He had big name endorsements. He had raised a staggering $1.04 million in his war chest, more than I've seen any other council member raise, over the past two decades. He had a lot of big endorsements, high name recognition, and comparatively, Nithya Raman, she had $250,000. So David Rue could have outspend her 4-1. Plus, he had independent expenditure money backing him.
Yeah, and Rue has been in office since 2015. What's his tenure been like? What have been his successes, his failures, according to the people he represents?
Well, what's really actually interesting about Rue is that he's not your stereotypical City Hall insider. He actually ran. He was not part of the political machine when he ran 5 years ago. He, you know, was pushing an effort of reform. And since he's been office, he's been pushing other reform-oriented efforts, such as trying to ban developer contributions.
Yeah. We had him in here talking about that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's been a really big thing for him. It took him a long time, and he was knocked down, and he kept pushing, and he got that passed. So, you know, he did he did succeed in pushing that. You know, he has tried to tout himself as progressive, touting efforts to create affordable housing, again, this government accountability, such as campaign finance reform, et cetera, et cetera.
Nithya Raman, his chief competitor. Tell us about her background and what kind of platform she's been running on.
She's really interesting. You know, Nithya Raman, she was formerly worked for the city administrative officer, and she'd most recently served as executive director of a nonprofit, the women's rights movement, Time's Up Entertainment. She's a Silver Lake resident, and, you know, her campaign, she was really seeking to position herself as the real progressive in this race. It seemed that she was trying to appeal to essentially the Bernie base. Just look on her website. It's right out there. You know, the front page talks about how she's seeking to end homelessness, protect immigrants, prevent a climate crisis, achieve racial inequality, make City Hall work for us. So she was really trying to position herself as the outsider to David Rue, who 5 years ago was that outsider.
Speaking of homelessness, how big of an issue has that been in this race?
Homelessness, I think, is an issue in every race and in every district. And, you know, look, City Hall has actually been making some progress. Projects are underway, permanent supportive housing, as well as temporary emergency shelters. But I think it's really easy right now for any outsider or anyone to say, look at the situation on the streets, look at the tent encampments, and they do exist in this district, and say that the people who are in office have not done enough, so we need to bring in someone who is an outsider. And Nithya Raman, you know, like everyone else, has a whole big platform to address homelessness.
It seemed as if Raman's campaign really kind of started cranking up recently, just in the last few weeks. How did her efforts compare to what Rue tried to do? And really, what can we take away from that when thinking about how much traction she eventually got?
Well, you're right. It did really seem to take off publicly within the past few weeks. But what's interesting is going back months, 3, 4, 5 months, I would hear from people within the neighborhood who would mention seeing, you know, the groundwork that she was doing, that she really did seem to be trying to, you know, lay that base out there and connect with a lot of people. I heard from a lot of folks within the area that she had a good, solid ground game, which could be seen as a reminder that all politics is local. But, you know, also let's not, you know, while she's there, let's not write off David Rue yet.
Right,
he's
yeah.
still, you know, he is still the incumbent. He still finished this within first place. He was still, you know, a small amount from winning this outright. So, you know, one could argue that he doesn't have as much as Nithya Raman does to try to win this, you know, to try to get to that 50%.
Talking LA City Council races with John Regardi, covers local politics for Los Angeles Magazine. All right, City Council District 10, that represents a big swath of South LA. Herb Wesson currently represents it, but his term expires at the end of this year. Two competitors who reached the top of the vote yesterday. First, there's current County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, captured over 45% of the vote. What were voters there liking about Mark Ridley Thomas's platform?
Mark Ridley Thomas is incredibly experienced. He's a veteran of politics. He's one of the most accomplished and savviest.
A known name, too.
Savviest. And, he's been in elected office for 30 years. And in fact, back in the 1990s, he served on the Los Angeles City Council. The first time I reported on him, he was a council member. We were talking about his efforts to bring professional football to the LA Memorial Coliseum.
I remember that whole thing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, Mark Ridley Thomas, he's had a lot of accomplishments, and he's addressed some of these issues that we've been talking about, such as homelessness. He was a leader in getting the approval of Measure H, which raised $355 million a year from county voters through a quarter-cent sales tax. He was the co-chair of Governor Gavin Newsom's state panel addressing homelessness. He helped reopen a very much-needed hospital in South Los Angeles. And, you know, he is also, you know, has touted and worked on progressive issues. Certainly in this race, others tried to position themselves even to the left of Mark Ridley Thomas, but he has always been strongly supported by labor organizations. So, you know, he is a known name, as you said.
What about his competitor, Grace Yu? Second time running for this seat, what issues was she running on?
Grace Yu, as you said, ran once before, got under 30% when she ran in 2015 against Wesson. She's an attorney. She does have some deep community ties. I think what she was trying to do was build a base within the portion of the district that is in Koreatown. She was sort of taking a platform that, hey, the city needs to repair and upgrade its infrastructure. It needs to respond to the climate crisis. We've got to end City Hall corruption. And of course, once again, address homelessness. I think she was really taking aim at a lot of the things that a lot of other candidates were doing. And, you know, one of the reasons that this may have come into a runoff is there were three other people on this ballot as well. And unlike the other race, which we just talked about, this one was not nearly as close. Mark Ridley Thomas, according to the latest numbers I've seen, he had nearly 47%. Grace Yu was just under 25% of the vote. So he did get pretty close.
One more thing, John, depending on how each of these races turn out, how do you see them maybe changing the composition and direction of what the city council tackles in the coming years?
Honestly, I don't think we're going to see much change in where city council goes. The body is already largely Democratic. It tends to move often in lockstep. If there is going to be a change, I think it would most likely be seen by, if Ridley Thomas wins, what he brings to the table. Because unlike Grace Yu or potentially Nithya Raman, he's not going to have a learning curve. He's been around so long that he knows how things work. He'd get in and he'd be an instant leader.
John Rigardi covers local politics for Los Angeles Magazine. John, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, eh?
All right, moving on. The future of the Orange County School of the Arts was decided at today's Orange County Board of Education meeting. KPCC's Carla Javier has been covering the embattled charter school's renewal. She's on the line now. Carla, welcome back.
Thanks, A, for having me on the show.
All right, so what happened today?
So today was the last act in the drama over the charter school's renewal. The Orange County Board of Education heard from both the Orange County School of the Arts and its authorizer for the past 20 years, Santa Ana Unified, and the Board of Education voted to take over as OSHA's authorizer and approved its charter as written, no conditions attached. So essentially a victory for the Orange County School of the Arts.
Wow. So what was that like?
Well, the whole thing took about an hour and a half. First, there were public comments, all in support of the school. Then presentations addressing the findings and recommendations sent to the board last week by the Orange County Department of Education staff.
That's right. Okay, so what did the County Department of Education staff have to say about all this in their report?
Yeah, the staff report raised similar concerns as Santa Ana Unified's report in December about the admissions process and proposed placement activities, about the way the school fundraises, and about its governance structure. Given all of that, the County Department of Ed staff actually did recommend that the board approve the school's charter and assume oversight of the school going forward, but they had some conditions, Those conditions included doing away with placement activities and portfolio reviews and admitting students by a public random drawing. Another suggested condition was to revise any materials soliciting parent donations to emphasize that they are voluntary. I should mention that a County Department of Education spokesperson declined to make that staff available who worked on the report, saying that the report speaks for itself.
All right, so that's the staff report. What did OCSA and Santa Ana Unified have to say about all of it?
Yeah, the Orange County School of the Arts founder and executive director, Ralph Opasek, recognized and responded to that report. He said he believes the changes the school has already made, like trading out auditions for what it calls placement activities, followed by a lottery, already addresses the staff's concerns about access. A slide that he put up said the school respectfully disagreed with those findings in the County Department of Education staff report. But, and now I'm reading directly from the slide, should it be considered a condition of approval, we are willing to update these practices as necessary. And then he ended his presentation with this closing remark.
OSHA staff believes that the charter that we submitted to the county is in full compliance with Ed Code and state law. We ask this board to be bold and give us an unconditional approval.
Afterwards, a deputy superintendent with Santa Ana Unified, Alfonso Jimenez, presented alongside a lawyer for the district.
We are here today to express our support of the Orange County Department of Education staff report, which found various areas which were of concern, which many of those concerns were also outlined in our staff report.
And you may remember that Santa Ana Unified's board had approved the school's charter in December with conditions.
Yeah, okay, so ultimately the Orange County Board of Education gets the last word, the final word on this, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so what did the members say?
There was a lot of board member discussion. Members asked questions of both OSHA and Santa Ana Unified about the things that came up in the staff report, about the school's admissions policies, how it fundraises, and its governance structure. And then ultimately, the discussion came down to the proposed conditions. Member Becky Gomez seemed to support approval with conditions.
I don't see what the harm would be in approving the petition with those conditions to assure that some of these changes have in fact been made.
As did another member, John Bedell.
I typically approve, I want to support this, but when there are conditions that raise questions that might in fact have negative impacts on this organization, that at least the addressing the conditions in the motion to approve protects this board and protects this institution.
And then after all that, the members of the County Board of Education voted. Here's what that moment sounded like. Member Ken Williams made the motion.
I am making boldly option as a motion, option number one, to approve the charter petition as written. And that was seconded by, I believe, Dr. Sparks.
I will now call for the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
Opposed.
Abstain.
Okay, so it passes 3-1-1. Thank you very much.
So much drama, Carla. Wow.
Yeah, I should say that the applause you just heard after the vote was actually much longer and louder than we can play on the radio
yeah,
right now.
Wow.
The supporters in the room did jump to their feet, and the school's founder and executive director gave hugs all around the room. It's hard to hear on that tape, so just to recap that, there are 5 members of the Orange County Board of Education. 3 of them, Board President Mari Barkey, Vice President Ken Williams, and Lisa Sparks, voted to approve the petition. Board Member Becky Gomez voted in opposition, and Board Member John Bedell abstained from the vote.
All right, so what happens now?
Well, OSHA's current charter with Santa Ana Unified is in effect until June 30th. So it sounds like, talking to the district and to the school, that Santa Ana Unified will still do oversight of the school until then. But starting July 1st, the Orange County Department of Education will be the oversight agency for the public charter school, and it looks like will be for the next 5 years.
That's KPCC's Carla Javier reporting on the future of the Orange County School of the Arts. Carla, great job.
Thank you so much.
All right, around America, there's this perception of Hollywood that it leans liberal, but even among those that do lean liberal, political battle lines are always drawn when it comes to Democratic candidates, and they have been drawn right now between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. We're going to hear in just a second who stands by each presidential candidate and really think about how similar they really are. That's coming up when Take Two continues, so stay with us. All right, the news does not stop here at KPCC. Luckily, we have Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered, here to keep us up to date.
Well,
what's up, Nick?
We certainly have a lot of coronavirus stories today, and there are too many for me to list, but you'll hear them on All Things Considered. Also, Fernando Guerra with Loyola Marymount will join us live to talk about how LA voters felt about the new vote centers and the long lines during yesterday's California primary. Generally, people didn't like the long lines.
Nobody.
KPCC's Kyle Stokes is tracking the new numbers as they come in this afternoon. He's going to have updates. And after a months-long contest that involves students across the country, NASA's getting ready to unveil the name of its newest Mars rover at JPL. I went with Matt Damon, but I don't think anybody's going to go with me on that one.
Wow.
All of it during All Things Considered at 4, after Marketplace at 3, in the frame at 3:30.
Again, NASA does not consult me.
No.
I come up with great names.
I don't doubt that.
All right. Nick, thanks a lot. Nick Roman, All Things Considered this afternoon.
All right. Thanks.
back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, Super Tuesday has come and gone, so now it's time to talk all things showbiz. So let's go on the lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The movie business continues to suffer due to the coronavirus scare, plus a look at the industry and who's siding with Biden or Sanders. Now, Rebecca Keegan's on vacation. We're joined today by John Horn, host of KPCC's arts and entertainment program, The Frame. Hello, John.
Hey, Abe.
All right, because it's still really fresh in our minds and throughout our newsroom, so let's talk Super Tuesday. Joe Biden scooped up 10 states. Bernie Sanders had key victories in four, including right here, California precincts. Still reporting results, so it could be a while before we have a Democratic candidate. That being said, Hollywood's influence on all this. Let's start off with Joe Biden. Who's coming out for Joe Biden in Hollywood?
Well, Sherry Lansing, the former head of Paramount Pictures, is hosting a Biden fundraiser this evening. The people who have come out in support of Joe Biden up to now, it's a pretty diverse group. Rob Reiner, Cher, George R.R. Martin, who wrote Game of Thrones, Vivica Fox, Mia Farrow, comedian Sandra Bernhard, Alyssa Milano. The list goes on, and the Sanders camp is almost as diverse.
Yeah, so tell us about Bernie Sanders' camp.
You got Susan Sarandon, filmmaker Michael Moore, director Adam McKay, Danny DeVito, Danny Glover, some music people, Ariana Grande, Bon Iver, Cardi B, Lizzo, and then...
A little bit.
The big question, though, is what's going to happen to the Warren and Mayor Pete people? Where are they going to go, assuming Warren drops out of the race or maybe they switch their allegiances? But the Mayor Pete people, it's another good list. Seth MacFarlane, Lee Daniels, Kevin Costner, Mark Duplass, Michael Fox, Sharon Stone, Alan Cumming. Elizabeth Warren, she's not out of the race, so I'm not going to talk about her supporters yet, but there's a lot of money and people still in play.
Yeah, they're free agents. They're almost like political free agents.
Very good sports analogy.
Does it matter, though, John, who's supporting these candidates? I mean, you think Hollywood has pull when it comes to the political race?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there is a bias against Hollywood from a lot of people, seen as kind of coastal elites.
A lot of red states think it's all the same thing. Hollywood's one big thing.
True, yeah. But they can write big checks. Yeah. And, you know, politics is all about money and it's all about raising money. And people in the business have a lot of money and they write big checks. So that is important. And there's still a lot of people who, like Steven Spielberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who are still on the sidelines. Haim Saban. So when those people start getting behind one of the two candidates, that's when I think the money spigots can really start to flow. So that will be important, and it's developing as we speak.
All right, so let's turn to other news that's dominating the headlines. That's coronavirus. Last week, we talked about the effect shuttered theaters in China were having on the global box office, but now other countries are following suit. How have these additional theater closures affected the film industry?
Well, it's not just China. China is 70,000 theaters that have been closed for weeks now. Now we're seeing theaters close in Korea, Japan, France, Italy. Italy's closing schools, banning spectators from sporting events. And now what's starting to happen is movie studios are saying, we're not going to release movies. So the news today was that the James Bond film No Time to Die, that was supposed to come out in a couple of weeks, is now not going to come out until November because they couldn't get theaters for it. Universal has postponed the release of 1917. Jojo Rabbit has been pushed by Searchlight. Paramount is pushing Sonic the Hedgehog. Pixar's Onward is all going to be postponed in terms of its foreign releases. So the foreign box office is more important than the domestic box office. So as long as theaters are closing and remain closed overseas, that's a huge problem for Hollywood.
This is Daniel Craig's last Bond movie, right?
Let's hope so, right? Idris Elba, who do we want next?
I don't know. I've got a bunch of... We can talk about
that. Okay, another conversation.
Show, yeah. Now, theater closure, though, not the only thing that's causing an impact here. Disney canceled events and major events like South by Southwest also being affected. What's going on with them?
So Disney canceled the rollout for its streaming service in Britain, and they blamed it from, you know, people who were worried about traveling. South by Southwest is a little bit more problematic. This is a huge music, tech, and film festival that starts the end of next week. Already Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, some other tech companies have pulled out. I've been to South by Southwest. It's about 200,000 people in Austin, and it is packed. Every venue, every bar, every hotel, every restaurant. So if you're worried about being with other people in close proximity, It's not a good place to go. And they're trying to figure it out. I mean, they don't know what their options are. They could cancel it. They could scale it back. I think we're going to have some more South by Southwest news in a couple of days. We have a piece about it on The Frame today.
Now, what about, say, Netflix, streaming company like Netflix?
Good. It's good. I mean, if you start looking at the stock market and the stock market.
You stay at home, right? You don't go out to the theater.
Yeah. Now, the stock market is not a barometer on all things, but it does show where sentiment is. And if you look closely at the stock market, and I did just before I came up here, compared to Disney, which is not only suffering because of theme parks, but cruise ships and movies opening, Netflix stock over the last couple of weeks is up 30% more than Disney. It's up a lot more than the overall market. Because if you're worried about going out, wouldn't you...
Stay home.
Yeah, stay home. There's like 10 million things on Netflix you can find and you can binge watch God knows what. So in terms of where people think there is, you know, a business opportunity, hand sanitizer and Netflix, I guess.
We're talking to John Horn, host of KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. All right, switching gears, but keeping up with a scary theme. Let's talk about Universal's Dark Universe films. But to better understand, we need to go back to 2017 when this movie was released.
The hieroglyph said she was named Amunet, chosen to be Egypt's next queen. But her thirst for power led her down a darker path, one that had to be stopped.
Because of your actions, this ancient power has returned.
All right, that was from 2017's The Mummy, starring Tom Cruise. John, remind us what this film was trying to do.
I was trying to get people into theaters. It failed.
I went.
Oh, you were the one.
I go to
okay. This was part of Universal's Dark Universe plan. It was kind of like Marvel's Cinematic Universe. Yeah. Their idea was take these properties like Frankenstein, Wolfman, and lard them with big stars like Tom Cruise in The Mummy. Johnny Depp was going to play the Invisible Man. Angelina Jolie was going to be in Bride of Frankenstein. I can't think of a better actor to play the Wolfman than Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Russell Crowe was going to play Dr. Jekyll. Maybe not so much Mr. Hyde. Javier Bardem was going to be Frankenstein. They were going to be big budget, big franchise plays. The Mummy bomb. So Universal said, what are we thinking? Let's scale back. Let's revisit these ideas. And they made, compared to The Mummy, which is probably about a $200 million movie, they made The Invisible Man for about $8 million.
Yeah, and it had a really good week. And give us a sense of what the film is like, The Invisible Man.
So The Invisible Man, as told in Lee Whannell's film, is told really from the point of view of a woman played by Elizabeth Moss, who's trapped in a marriage that she can't escape. And she thinks she's left her husband. And this is not a spoiler. It's given away very quickly. She leaves, and then there's reports that he's committed suicide. Maybe he hasn't. Maybe he's stalking her. But no one believes that this guy is after her. So in some ways, it's not only a really original idea, it's a really relevant idea. It's about a woman who believes that a man is doing bad things to her and no one will believe her. And not only was it successful in its own right, I think we're going to see The Invisible Woman with Elizabeth Moss in a couple of years.
Because that's the thing. I mean, it kind of went back to basics, right? In terms of a horror movie formula, it's small budget, realism, enough to really freak people out.
Yeah. I mean, it's a well-made film, and it, I think, has appeal to women and men, young and old. But the most important thing, it cost a fraction of the Mummy. It still costs a lot of money to release these films, but it didn't cost nearly as much as The Mummy. And I think it really proved that if you do a movie well, you don't have to spend a lot of money. Elizabeth Moss is the only recognizable actor in the cast. And yet it opened well. It's got great word of mouth. The reviews were fantastic. Everything The Mummy wasn't, The Invisible Man is.
So does that mean that Universal's Dark Universe has a bright future?
I think it does.
Come on, give me that one.
Unless you're really dying to see Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Wolfman. Yes, I think it proves that Universal, and they did this with Blumhouse, and that's the company that's behind really good horror movies like Get Out, that if you get a good director, you get a good story, it doesn't matter the scale or the stars. You can make a good scary movie that is about those characters, the Invisible Man, and not spend a lot of money, and people will still show up.
I've always said this about Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He will play me in the A. Martinez life story. He just needs to bulk up at the gym a little bit. He just needs to, gain some weight.
He does, and also learn how to speak.
John Horn is host of KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. You can catch the show later today at 3:30 and at 7. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, hey.
All right, so we've checked in on some of the LA County races, also some national and state ones as well. Coming up next, Orange County gets under the Take Two microscope. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. All right, let's wrap up today with a check-in on how primary day went in Orange County. As with LA County, traditional polling places in Orange County have been replaced with voting centers, resulting in some of the same complaints from voters there about the new system. With us to discuss how it all played out in Orange County is Nick Gerda, reporter for The Voice of OC. Nick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Just to start off, tell us how was your experience voting yesterday?
Yeah, so I actually live in LA County and work in Orange County. And at my local vote center in LA County, there was about an hour-long wait at lunchtime. I counted about 117 people in line who were very determined to make sure that their voice was heard and their vote was counted. One of the differences between LA County and Orange County is in Orange County, every single voter, all 1.6 million, were sent out vote-by-mail ballots about a month before the election, whereas in LA County, you had to request it in order to receive it. So a lot of those voters in line in LA County didn't really have the option to just drop off a mail-in ballot. In my case, I had my mail-in ballot with me. I just, once I saw the line, I was a little short on time, so I filled out my ballot, dropped it off, and headed down to Orange County, and ended up being a little bit of a preview of some of the issues down in OC. Overall, OC didn't have as widespread of the issues as LA, but certainly certain locations, particularly around universities and colleges, had long lines of sometimes up to 2 hours.
All right, so let's talk about all the changes. First, the move from polling places to a smaller number of vote centers. The hope was that even though there were fewer locations to vote, that having them open days in advance would spread out the amount of in-person voters leading up to Super Tuesday. Did that prove to be true?
A little bit, but not as much as I think a lot of folks were expecting. So essentially, there would have been about 1,200 precincts, the traditional polling places, if this had been under the previous election approach. This time, they went down to about 188, 189 vote centers. So you had a lot more voters per center, but the idea was when you back it out to multiple days of voting ahead of time, it kind of spreads that out, so there's not as much impact at any particular time. But from what I was hearing from a lot of voters, they're used to voting on election day. They love the civic experience of, you know, being with other community members and voting on election day. So a lot of people did actually vote on election day. And also on the Democratic side, a lot of candidates were dropping out and coalescing late in the game. So a lot of voters were kind of waiting to see how that would shake out and then voting on election day. So you had a big surge of in-person voting on election day. Much more, I think, than was anticipated, and it created these long lines. Another factor was, for the first time, you could actually vote at any of this, both in LA and Orange County, any vote center, not just your local precinct. So people were choosing ones that were convenient to them at locations they knew, where they had ample parking, places like Santa Ana College, Cal State Fullerton, a lot of the universities that have, you know, lot of density around them. And so those were the most particularly impacted places, while sometimes vote centers just a few blocks away had virtually no lines. So there was a lot of kind of unevenness where people were showing up and there were these long lines again, sometimes up to 2 hours.
And the way I see it, Nick, is we're all trying something new. I probably will try to go the first day a voting center opens as opposed to what I tried yesterday, which is, as you said, go on election day and you know, be
sure
with everyone else. So maybe I might rethink my options in November. Now, despite the problems, it does seem like a lot of voters turned out. So what's your sense on that? When will we know the final tally in Orange County?
Yeah, so ballots can still come in through Friday evening by the mail as long as they were postmarked on election day. So we won't really know the final picture until Friday evening. And even on a lot of these races, the results are not final because there's still more votes rolling in. But overall, what we're seeing, according to Register Our Voters Neil Kelly here in Orange County, is amongst the ballots they already have is about a 45% turnout. Likely will bump up above that as more ballots come in through the mail. But that's pretty much on par with 2016, which was an unusually high turnout in Orange County for a primary election. So it's really reflective of more voter energy and enthusiasm to participate than we've really seen in a long time. And Orange County's continued to trend in that direction amidst also more competitive elections here as well.
Now, one thing about the mail-in ballots, LA County residents had to request a mail-in ballot. I think you mentioned earlier Orange County automatically sent mail-in ballots to everyone, all registered voters in the county. party. How many people relied on those?
Yeah, so we're, you know, obviously there's still more coming in the coming days. But what we saw as of the day before the election, about 350,000 people in Orange County had sent in mail-in ballots that were already received by the registrar. So that's about 20% of all registered voters. That's a pretty significant portion of the electorate that was opting to vote early through the mail. And, you know, again, this went out to every single registered voter in Orange County to their registered address a month ahead of time. So people had a lot of time to think about it, do research. People really taking advantage of that opportunity to vote early. And the campaigns also had to react to that. Usually they were waiting till the last minute in past elections to drop a bunch of ads, but they knew that they had to start hitting voters, you know, weeks ahead of time to catch those early ballots.
Talking with Nick Gerda, reporter for The Voice of OC. All right, let's turn to the races. The races in Orange County. A main narrative maybe that you're seeing from the results so far?
Yeah, so it's a mixed bag. It's a status quo in a lot of seats, but not in others. One of the status quos is there was an attempted Democrat takeover of the County Board of Education, which decides on whether to approve charter schools. That seems to have really flamed out. The Republicans are retaining their majority, backed by charter school advocates. The Democrats are backed by teachers unions. And so the Republicans are going to keep their 4-1 majority on that education board. But then in some of the other races, you're seeing much more competition. And in some cases, even one Republican incumbent assemblyman may actually be knocked out from his office in the primary, which is a very, very rare thing to see.
Tell us about him, because, yes, a few isolated incidents where the status quo might not prevail.
Exactly. The big one is South Orange County, which is a typically very conservative Republican area, solidly Republican district in the state assembly there, currently represented by Bill Bro, a Republican. And he is now placed currently in fourth place in the results in the latest count. Again, there's still more ballots to come in, so that's not a final result. But he's currently in fourth, and it's only the top two candidates that make the runoff in November. So if that holds and he doesn't make it into second place or first place, then he will be not able to run in November, and that seat will then be up to voters to decide between a Republican and a Democrat in November. And then another one in Orange County is Tyler Diep. He's an state assemblyman, Republican, running for re-election against Janet Nguyen, former state senator, and Democrat Garden Grove Councilwoman Deidre Nguyen. And Diep, the incumbent, is currently pretty close to third place. He's in second currently. It's about a 1% margin, so we're keeping an eye on that to see if he makes it to the runoff or if he also becomes knocked out in the primary.
One more thing really quick, just a few seconds here, Nick. Given some of the voting day snafus, are officials in Orange County talking about changes for November?
Yeah, at this point, they're not talking about specific changes. We've started to ask some questions about, you know, was there reallocation of resources to these higher impacted vote centers? Mm-hmm. So we're starting to kind of process what was going on last night. At this point, Neil Kelly, who's generally pretty widely respected amongst both sides of the aisle in Orange County, he's saying that they're going to be taking a look at all this and looking at ways to improve voting going forward. But at this point, he's pretty happy with how it went.
All right. Nick Gerda, reporter for the nonprofit news site Voice of OC. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so you can always catch Take Two wherever you get your podcast. Just go look for us there. We will be right there waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.